This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Over the last six decades, Dolly Parton has become an icon in country music and one of the most beloved musicians anywhere in the world. She just released her 49th solo studio album, and it's the highest charting album of her career. And yet, with all that behind her, when she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2022, she did so with a certain sense of trepidation, even a little embarrassment.
I'll tell you what, this is a very, very, very special night for me. I'm sure a lot of you knew that back when they said they were going to put me in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I didn't really feel like I had done enough to deserve that.
Flash forward and 1 year and Dolly Parton, age 77, has just released her first rock album. The album mixes covers from the rock and roll canon, along with Parton's original songs like the title track, Rockstar. Emily Lordy is a music writer based in Nashville who's written for The New Yorker about Gladys Knight and Mariah Carey and other greats, and she recently spoke with Dolly Parton.
So to get started, I wanted to actually refer back to our last conversation in 2020, where you said something that has stayed with me ever since. And you said that it's not true that you have never been afraid. You said you are afraid, you do experience fear, but your desire to do something has always been greater than your fear. And I'm wondering what, if anything, scared you about this project.
Well, it really was... You got to take on a thing like this, and you got to hopefully make sure that you're going to do it good. Just making the decision to do a rock album, it was made easier when they decided to go ahead and put me in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And as you know, that little bit of controversy or whatever it was, I didn't feel like I had earned it. But they told me that I had, and then when I went in, I thought, well, I'm going to have to at least have something to say that I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I was a little bit, I guess, more apprehensive, I guess. I was just more afraid that I might not do it as good as, I wanted the rock people to be proud of me. Let's put it that way. I thought, well, I want this to be good. I don't want them to say, did you hear Dolly's rock album? It's okay. She did okay. But I wanted them to say, did you hear Dolly's rock album? Man, she killed it. And so I kind of went through those kind of emotions more than just a deep fear. I was determined I was going to do it. And I thought, well, I'll cover up any fear I might have by bringing on some of these great people that I know will make it great.
And one thing that's interesting to me is that the album includes 9 of your original songs, including World on Fire and I Want You Back. And there are 21 classic songs, monster anthems like Purple Rain, Stairway to Heaven, Free Bird. And it seems like an incredibly and beautifully audacious move for you to set some of your own original rock songs against some of these greatest rock songs ever made. And so I'm wondering if you felt that that was audacious, or what gave you the courage and the confidence to do that?
Well, one good, strong reason was Kent Wells, who he's the guy that produced the album, and he's been my musical director and guitar player for 30 years. And I knew that he was a secret rocker, and I knew that I could depend on him to kind of help us with the melodies on these original songs that would fit in with what we were doing, where they really would be like rock songs, not just a country version of a rock song. So I depended on him a lot. Now, I really felt the songs held up, and I thought they really went well with the other songs. It's like you think, well, if you're going to put something in it, you don't want to just do it to say, oh, I wrote some of the songs and I can publish them. I can make the money from the publishing. Of course, I did think that. But I wasn't just thinking that. I thought, well, you know, I really need to have something really good so people know that I'm an artist too, that I'm a writer and that I can do this.
So you and Kent Wells wrote a lot of the songs together.
And I wrote some on my own. I wrote the title song, Rockstar. I thought, well, I got to have a little story to tell. And I thought, what am I going to write the title song about? And then I thought, well, I'll write it about a girl rocker. So I kind of channeled Joan Jett and Melissa Etheridge, who both play great guitar, and they're really, really great rockers. And they're both on the album, by the way, doing different songs. But anyway, I kind of channeled them and wrote a little story about a rock star having a fight with her parents and, you know, them thinking, well, what in the world do you want to get in rock and roll? And so I thought it turned out real cute.
I'm wondering if you, being sort of at the center of our collective affection, was there any tension for you between being such a beloved figure and playing the part of the rebel rock star?
No, I figure people that know me and love me have to love me as I am, doing whatever it is I do. I think that's actually part of it. They know that I'm going to take chances and that I feel like I have a right. Another thing, I've been in this music business for a long time, 6 decades, as a matter of fact, and people feel like they know me, and they're willing to allow me to try things and to respect me for it. I think that's what I hope.
Yeah. I'm interested in the fact that so many of the songs on the album are covers, and yet, of course, you're renowned for writing your own songs, as we were talking about. But, you know, since covering songs is its own creative process, I'm curious to know whether there were any patterns that you detected in your approaches to covering other people's songs. Like, were there certain things that you noticed you kept wanting to do in order to dollify some of these classic rock songs?
Well, I tried hard not to dollify them too much. I have a certain way of singing. I have a certain sound in my voice. It's very identifiable. I guess they call that being a stylist. I'm like Willie Nelson or Patsy Cline. It's a voice you know when you hear it, whether you like it or not. You don't always like that voice, but I know how I phrase and I know how things just come out of me. But I was trying hard to be careful not to really make these songs like country songs. I wanted the phrasing to be good. Not in country music, I can sing any way, anywhere. However, if I want to sing on top of the beat or lag along to whatever, but my voice is so identifiable, I just wanted to choose songs that would fit my voice, that I felt my range would cover, and that my style, that I could sing with emotion without over-singing them or trying to sing gimmicky or any of that. But I wanted to not have people think, oh, she just sang all over that or she did too much on that. I tried to be respectful of the songs.
There are some moments where I feel you are reaching and it's a glorious sound. For instance, on the outro to Stairway to Heaven, and I don't know that I have ever heard you belt quite so high. And I'm curious if you would speak to that and maybe more generally to how covering these songs, even as you said you wanted songs that would fit your range, how did they push you to explore new edges as an artist or as a vocalist?
That's a good question, because I had some fun and some decisions to make when I was in the studio singing. Just like, for instance, I was really singing that Stairway to Heaven. I was really into that song. And it had never crossed my mind that I would ever try to do that high part, you know, like that Robert Plant did. But as the song was going by, I knew that was so high that I was going to strain my milk doing it. But I was just going by there, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go for it. And so I just started singing that part, because that was the kind of thing I would have thought that we would just do with music or maybe do with background. But when I led into it, I thought, I can hit it. I can do it. But I busted a gut. That was as high as I could go. But I did it. I thought, well, can I get a little emotion with this thing being this high? But it was a challenge, and it was fun. And it just happened on the spur of the moment. I just went for it. I would listen to the music, and I thought, I've never had this chance before. I've never had this freedom before to even, to actually challenge myself. You know, with these great melodies, because I write so much of my own stuff, and so I kind of live comfortably in that. But I thought, well, I'm just going to go for it. Worst can happen, we won't use it. Nobody will ever know if it don't sound good. So it was a treat for me. I had a lot of fun doing it.
I also noticed that in your collaborations, you know, you do some incredible collaborations on this record. Interestingly, there's a lot of women collaborators, such as Miley Cyrus. You bring in Pink, Brandi Carlile, Stevie Nicks, Lizzo, Linda Perry.
And Ann Wilson, my God, you know, getting to sing with her. That was another great challenge I had when we were singing in the studio. I thought, I can't let her get ahead of me. I mean, of course, she can sing, but buddy, I was right on her tail. I was just thinking, you hit that note, I'll hit this one. You hit that one, I'll hit that one. So we were just having fun, you know, we were really just kind of in a good singing musical competition, but it was fun.
Do you feel like you can be a little freer to take those risks now at this stage in your career that you might not have gone for it in the studio however many years ago, but you're willing to do it now?
Yeah, I think there's a whole lot of freedom that comes with getting older. And when you've done everything, you don't have to answer to other people. You know, it's like, why wouldn't I be allowed to do this? You know, at my age, I'm 77 years old and I'm a rock star. You know, I get a kick out of it. And that's when the title of the album, it was kind of like a little tongue-in-cheek kind of thing. I thought, what am I going to call this album? Well, I'm going to call it Rock Star, duh. So I'm willing to take more chances now because I can afford to in my career and afford to financially. Used to, you know, back when I love mountain music. I mean, I love mountain music and bluegrass music, but you never can really make a lot of money with doing that. But when I've started making money, I said I had to get rich in order to sing like I was poor again, because that's the music, you know, that I love, because I still feel that and I can still sing it with feeling. So when I was doing the rock album, I thought, man, this is an opportunity for me. As a singer, and as an artist, and as a person, I thought, well, why don't I have a right to try it? So I'll take any chance if it feels right to me.
There are, as we've said, so many women that you collaborate with on the record. I'm wondering, was it a conscious decision for you to change the story a little bit from the rock as a boys' club idea and show that women belong there just as much as men do?
Well, I didn't think of it into that depth, I just knew I was a girl and I was going to do rock and roll. And I knew there were some great girl rock and rollers, especially, you know, in the early days, like Joan and Melissa and some of the others. But I thought, well, I need to make this kind of about a girl rocker. I mean, I'm a girl and I'm going to be singing these rock and roll songs. And then, of course, I love singing with all these women. And so I thought, well, I'm going to ask some of them if they'll join me. Like with Joan, she was the sweetest thing. Joan Jett, when I said I wanted to do I Love Rock and Roll, she said, oh, Dolly, don't do that one. Everybody does that one. Won't we do I Hate Myself for Loving You? It's got a little more meat and you're a little more, you know, she said, you got a little more depth than just singing I Love Rock and Roll, which I thought was great because she's a writer. It was conscious in the respect that I thought I needed to have, you know, a lot of these girls on here. I wasn't trying to do any Me Too movement or, you know, to really make a big statement of any kind. It just seemed to be the songs that I wanted to do, and these seemed to be the voices that I heard on them.
And I love how you bring out the reference to I Will Always Love You on the collaboration with Miley Cyrus on Wrecking Ball, and how you bring that lyric in and she sings it with you in the end of that song. It kind of sounds to me like you're singing with her on her song, but then ultimately she's also singing with you on your song. And there's just that sense of history, in other words, built into the record.
Yeah, well, I love Miley. You know, I've known her since before she was born. She's kind of like my fairy goddaughter, and we have a great deal of love for each other. And we love to sing together, and I think our voices really, really work well together. And when I got ready to do the rock album, I thought, wow, I'm going to try to incorporate a little bit of I Will Always Love You in this, and I'll you know, do the Wrecking Ball, which is one of my favorite songs ever, and certainly since it was Miley, made it twice as special. We know where we're going to go. When we're singing, I can pretty much anticipate what note she's going to go for, and so I know kind of how to do little things around her and vice versa. She knows how, you know, we're so familiar with our voices. Or we'll think at the same second, wow, we can go here. Let's do this.
I read somewhere that you had hoped to collaborate with Tina Turner on this album. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, I had written a song that I thought would just be perfect for us. And so I had sent it over for her to hear. And so then I got word back that she was in very bad health. That was really toward the end of her life. But they said she liked it and said she was so sorry she didn't get an opportunity to do it with me. But I would have loved for that to have happened because I love Tina Turner, always have.
I wanted to switch gears just a little bit and talk about one of your videos for one of the tracks on the record, which is the video you do for What's Up with Linda Perry. I understand that you filmed it at Aiken Elementary School here in Nashville. I don't know what your intention was with the song and pairing it with that visual. However, I found the shot of the kids running down the hallway. There's a black and white shot of them running down the hallway that I personally found rather chilling in light of the recent school shootings here in Nashville and elsewhere. But in the video, they run out onto the playground. Could you speak to some of that and what you were thinking with that choice?
Well, first of all, I love that song. And then Steve Summers, who also does all of my clothes, he's my creative director. He came up with the idea for us to do this, and we talked about it, doing it with kids, you know, and I changed a few lines in it to make it more kid-friendly, you know, that part where it says I step out and take a deep breath and get real high. I didn't want that to sound like somebody smoking dope, so I changed it, and I take a deep breath and I wonder why, for the video, because if I was going to have children, I didn't want it to, you know, seem like I was trying to make some sort of a bad statement. But I, in my mind, when Steve and I were talking, we were thinking that it was more about the future, like what's going on in this world, in this crazy world. Are we going to deprive our children of a future? You know, it's like you just want to think, get a grip, and let's change things, and let's do it right, if not for us, for the children.
What you were saying about the meaning of what's up paired to the video made me wonder about World on Fire, of course, which is a similar kind of Jeremiad and asking people to think about what is happening.
Now, I ain't one for speaking out much, but that don't mean I don't stay in touch. Everybody's tripping over this or that. What we gonna do when we all fall flat? Liar, liar, the world's on fire. What we gonna do when it all burns down? I don't know.
I'm wondering what your most immediate inspiration for that song was.
Well, it was the inspiration of what's going on just right now all over this world. And it's like, look around. Can't you see the world on fire? Not just literally, but, you know, in every way. You know, that was back during the fires and everything, too. But I was really just thinking about in that one verse that I had said that was, everybody said I was being political. You know, when I said, greedy politicians, present and past, wouldn't know the truth if it bit them in their astronomical egos, basically. But I was really saying, you know, in my heart and in my mind, leaders of the world, you know, you better think fast. You better, you know, you need to make it change. I just don't get it, that we're just willing to just hold on to some sort of a belief so strong that we can't see that we're allowing that to destroy us when we could just care a little more, try a little harder, do all that. So the only way I know how to fight back is to write songs, to say how I feel. And that song I felt really led to write. And it's just me trying to throw some light on a dark, you know, on some dark subjects these days.
I'm curious, though, about the line in World on Fire. You say, Billy got a gun, Joey got a knife, Janie got a sign to carry in the fight. Is there an equivalence there between the armed violence and a kind of peaceful protest with the signs, or is that not what you meant?
It was just what you see in the streets every day, you know, if like whatever, you know, it's just as I was trying to be as poetic as I could to try to get the point across. You know, people are marching in the streets, people are killing one another, people are, you know, destroying each other, and the ones that are not doing that are carrying a sign that's, you know, saying whatever. So it was just about the times. It's just about what's going on in the world. You know, they got their guns, they got their knives, they got their signs, they got their marchings, they've got this and that. And I understand the frustration in everybody. I understand the frustration in myself, but the only way I know how to deal with it is to be able to express it in music, because that's kind of how God has given me that voice. And so that's what I will continue to do. And anytime I see that there's a need that I can feel or something that I can do personally to make life a little better, I will continue to do that. I'll leave my heart wide open, you know, for any goodness that I can, and try to be open to maybe a little more caring and understanding.
I'm really grateful for the time and energy you've given to us, and thanks again for the incredible work.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm glad you love the record, so thank you.
Dolly Parton's new album is called Rockstar, and you can read some of Emily Lordy's essays on music and more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As we lurch painfully into another election season, we can't seem to avoid the phrase, democracy hangs in the balance yet again. We've been saying that since 2016, and sadly, alarmingly, it's even more the case today. Donald Trump is ahead of Joe Biden in many polls, and he certainly isn't chastened by his efforts to overturn the last election, and he certainly isn't chastened by his legal troubles. Instead, he's called to suspend parts of the Constitution and recently called his political enemies vermin, a word out of Hitler and Mussolini. And this year's chaos in Congress, the like of which we hadn't seen in our history, certainly doesn't give you much comfort. So how did we get here? And can we ever get from here to safer ground where we can argue about things like tax rates? That's a question that some of The New Yorker's best thinkers on politics gathered to discuss recently. Jelani Cobb, Jill Lepore, and Evan Osnos are all staff writers and collectively the authors of a huge pile of excellent books on American history and cultural life. They came together at the New Yorker Festival for a conversation moderated by Michael Luo, the editor of NewYorker.com. Here's Michael.
Jill, Jelani, Evan, thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
So I want to start on a very New Yorker note with a reading of E.B. White's famous essay, The Meaning of Democracy, which originally appeared in the notes and comments section of the July 3rd, 1943 issue of The New Yorker. E.B. White, of course, was maybe the greatest magazine essayist of the 20th century. The occasion for the piece was a letter from the Writers War Board, a group of authors who were meant to help shape public opinion on the Allied effort in World War II. So here it is. We received a letter from the Writers War Board the other day asking for a statement on the meaning of democracy. It presumably is our duty to comply with such a request, and it's certainly our pleasure. Surely the board knows what democracy is. It is the line that forms on the right. It is the don't and don't shove. It is the hole in the stuffed shirt through which the sawdust slowly trickles. is the dent in the high hat. Democracy is the recurrent suspicion that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time. It is the feeling of privacy in the voting booths, the feeling of communion in the libraries, the feeling of vitality everywhere. Democracy is a letter to the editor. Democracy is the score at the beginning of the ninth. It is an idea which hasn't been disproved yet, a song the words of which have not gone bad. It's the mustard on the hot dog and the cream in the ration and coffee. Democracy is a request from a war board in the middle of a morning, in the middle of a war, wanting to know what democracy is. God. I almost choked up there. FDR loved this essay. He read it all the time. What do you sort of take away from that essay about why we are here today, the meaning of democracy? I don't know, Jelani, put you on the spot if you want to start.
You know, I think a democracy in terms of, you know, that saying about experience, you know, say experience is what you get when you come in second place, you know, and so, you know, democracy is what you get when you lose and still hold faith in the idea that you could win is the always, you know, wait till next year idea of it. Obviously, that's something that we have taken for granted for a long time and then thought maybe we really shouldn't take that for granted.
Jill?
There's a part of me that wants to, well, the large part of me wants to embrace, I think, a lot of the sentimentality around E.B. White's perception of democracy. I think about the free library card, bringing your kid to kindergarten at a public school for the first time and belonging to that world. But in this moment in time, I think democracy really is only as strong as your willingness to lose. And so I guess I really kind of come to that very same place. I think our willingness to lose is quite a fragile thing right now. Mm.
I think my dominant reaction when I hear that is, oh my God, the standards of the New Yorkers are, it's so high, it's so hard. Our predecessors were so good. There's a line in there that really rings true to me, which is that, you know, the idea that more than half of the people can be right more than half of the time, that fraction, which is a big idea, and it's sort of embedded in that is the idea of the consent of the loser, that fraction is only true as long as many people are participating in democracy. Are we, in fact, doing the work of preventing voter suppression, of getting people into the opportunity to participate in politics? Is our system catching up with the reality of life on the ground?
Can I weigh in? So there's a thing, you know, going in that same line about more than half of the people being right more than half of the time. It doesn't mean that more than half of the people are never wrong. Mm. And it's important to keep that in mind. Because we have an amazing liability in the United States, and that is our conception of ourselves as exceptional. Being exceptional is like being rich or being good looking. It's better for other people to say that about you than for you to say it about yourself. And so because we don't easily engage with the areas in which we fall short, or when you bring up the areas in which we have fallen short, you're accused of, quote unquote, wanting to tear the country down, which is something I hear all the time. It was like, no, we're actually trying to immunize ourselves against our worst instincts.
Jill, you said something about sentimentality of the piece. It's kind of out of fashion a little bit to feel that way, maybe about our country, about our democracy. Like, what were you reacting to when you were talking about that?
Yeah, so I actually read that E.B. White piece when I was working on a piece for the magazine. I was kind of surprised to see how ubiquitous were panel discussions like this in the 1930s. By the time it gets to 1943 and he gets the letter from the war board, he's kind of exhausted by it, right? Like, it's become a trite thing. Like, we have all probably been on the democracy talk circuit lately because it's all anybody, you know, we should be talking about. One of the things that really struck me, comparing maybe my experience of being on in panels like this with the tenor of some of those conversations in the 30s, was the extraordinary affection for ordinary people that was part of that 1930s vibe, the documentary populism of a Dorothea Lange, the Federal Writers Project, people going around collecting stories of ordinary people, the celebration of the everyday, the folk music, meant that when people talked about democracy, they talked about their affection for ordinary people, for daily life. You know, like if we were to sit here and be like, you know, the democracy is skateboards and FIFA on my video player or whatever, like it's just things that are like regular.
Democracy is my YouTube algorithm.
Yeah, but we don't, you know, so when people were making projects whose aim was to cultivate democracy, they were full of affection. But I also know that I am of this world and I, you know, I'm not going to wax poetic about the ninth inning right now.
I don't know. That FIFA thing got me a little teared up.
I mean, Jelani, you wrote a book about the Obama presidency. It was published in 2010, mm-hmm. and then you had to, I guess they republished it in 2020, and you wrote a new introduction. Mm-hmm. And you wrote, Obama's emergence was tied to his ability to articulate a transcendent vision of American identity, one in which the traditional divides of partisanship and race would be of less consequence than the overarching bond of citizenship. So what was it about America that enabled us to elect a man named Barack Hussein Obama as president of the United States and then 8 years later elect Donald John Trump?
So, I mean, I think it's not that complicated, actually. I think it's the same thing that allowed us to revoke the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment and lynch people for voting. Same society where people from all geographic lines and racial backgrounds participated in the civil rights movement. I mean, if we went all the way back to the fundamental dichotomy of the people who founded this country and the way that they subsidized their mission of liberty with the lives of slaves. And so we've always been engaged in that dialectic.
Hmm. Jill, do you have a perspective on that kind of dialectic?
What's a little bit odd about our contemporary moment is that people seem to wish that they could choose one or the other of those accounts of the American past, the one that sort of maps onto their political preferences. And I think that's incredibly dangerous. So I remember at the time Trump was elected, I was like a bit more than halfway through writing this 1,000-page history of the United States. And then he was elected, and I was going to end with Barack Obama's inauguration. That was going to be like my final chapter. I was like, this is great. People are so excited. And then Trump was elected, and I had to like quickly add like 10 pages. And then when I went to talk to people and the book came out in 2018, people kept saying to me, how did you write this history of the country so fast? The whole book explains Trump. And I was like, no, the whole book explained Obama. I just added Trump. Like, the whole book explains both of them because it's the both sides of the coin. Like, it's just the cleaving of the story into two. You know, people on one side want to believe the history of the country is a history of, you know, the march of freedom and a triumph of capitalism. And on the other side want to believe it, this history of the country is a litany of atrocity and exploitation. And both are true, but also that means neither is true. I think it really impoverishes our political conversation to deploy these really polarized histories in this way, which is, you know, why we have these doofus waste of energy history wars in the classroom right now.
If I can just add something to that, I think that the interesting thing about the deployment of history in ways that are used to rationalize contemporary politics. And so when I was talking with my students about W.E.B. Du Bois and the book that he published in 1935, Black Reconstruction, which was meant to turn the entire understanding of Reconstruction on its head, to say that it had actually been an experiment in democracy and that the emancipation of slaves had been a good thing and that the enfranchisement of Black people had been a good thing and that these governments did useful, worthwhile things for the time that they existed. The prevailing narrative prior to that had been that all of these things were an unmitigated disaster. And that argument was being used to justify Jim Crow. And so now I think it's kind of brazen and, you know, really shocking to see the extent to which we're seeing history just photoshopped in order to provide a narrative that aligns itself so directly and with such kind of a one-to-one ratio to the political project that's also being undertaken right now.
Evan, you went to the Capitol on January 6th. I think I might have called you.
Yeah, you sent me there, Mike. I didn't just go.
Evan, you got to get there.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, you're like, one of us has to get there, man. What really struck me about it, and gets to the sort of deeper problem that we're contending with, it was not actually the guys, and they were guys, with the flags that they were spearing the police officers with. In some ways, that was a phenomenon that I understand. What struck me was when I was talking to people on the edges of it, grandmothers who had joined in this delusion, the idea that they believed that they were doing something noble when they were engaged in this wretched act of insurrection, we're really just beginning to understand how the sort of collapsing compact between those people and their sense of government would affect our lives. Just one fact that's notable. Of the people I talked to there, I was struck how many of them told me that it was their first trip to Washington. They came for the first time to sack the Capitol.
That's Evan Osnos. He's speaking with fellow staff writers Jelani Cobb, Jill Lepore, and Mike Luo. We'll continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and we're hearing today from three great thinkers who met to talk about the state of democracy, all of them staff writers at The New Yorker. Michael Luo moderated our conversation with Jill Lepore, Jelani Cobb, and Evan Osnos. Here's Mike Luo.
Jelani, you, one of your specialties is the as a historian is the post-Civil War era. What about this moment resembles that time in our history and what is different.
You know, there are people in this country who are believers in democracy. And then there are people whose primary faith is in power. And if democracy will yield power for them, then fine. And if they can't get power through democracy, then their allegiance is to whatever mechanism will keep them empowered. You have to cook the history books in order to get to that version that we talk about, the kind of gleaming perfect. We start out as great and have only gotten better, you know, idea of American identity and American history. And by subscribing to that idea, it makes it difficult for you to really look at Reconstruction and what happened. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, it was a tantamount to restarting, you know, the rebooting the country because you abolished slavery, you created equal protection under the laws and birthright citizenship, and then you gave limited enfranchisement to black people, black men specifically. And the reason that I've been such an evangelist for understanding black history is that it is a phenomenally convenient barometer of America's tolerance of anti-democracy. The 5,000 or so people who were lynched, that was done in order to prevent democracy. We say it was like, oh, it was done in order to terrorize black people and so on and so forth. In Mississippi, the population of Mississippi was half black. 50% of the population could not vote. So those actions were meant to forestall democracy. And so we have to actually grapple with that if we want to have a clear gauge of what's happening with around us right at this moment.
Jill, you're in these truths, you're one of the themes that comes through is the fragility of the American experiment, that the outcome is not assured. I mean, what are you thinking about the outcome these days?
I was reading this kind of wacky book by this Yale Law School scholar Jack Belkin recently called Constitutional Time. And he has this crazy cosmological pattern that he's proposing. And I'm going to get this wrong, but it's sort of, you imagine there's the, you know, the Earth's own rotation on its axis, and then the Earth's orbit around the sun, and then the moon's orbit around the Earth. And so imagine those are three different patterns. So one of them is constitutional time, like the patterns of amendment and revision. One of them is polarization. Let's say the other one's income inequality, right? This is not what Balkan uses because he's not interested in that, but I would say that's the third thing that's most important. And he's like, okay, so we're in a perfect eclipse right now because the Constitution has become unamendable. Our polarization is at a peak, and he's not talking about pretend he's talking about income inequality, right? So where like the sky is completely dark because the sun is blocking, the moon is blocking where we are standing on the planet. I was very drawn to this notion that we're in a perfect storm, that all of these forces at the moment have lined up. But where I was completely unpersuaded is they're not separate systems, right? Income inequality drives polarization. Polarization drives income inequality. If you're trying to make an XY axis, like everything starts falling apart in 1968, just when the country really becomes a multiracial democracy. It's difficult to imagine how such a well-aligned set of crises, like which one do you tackle first? Like for me, I just decided as a historian, all right, I'm going to start thinking hard about the Constitution. And the other things are just kind of harder to think through. But if everybody would just kind of concentrate on income inequality, and we would talk more about the have yachts and the not have yacht.
Please use the technical term. It's the haves and the have yachts.
Right. We need to talk more about the haves and the have yachts, and kind of less about like, what is the good thing you can do today as a citizen? Disenfranchise the rich? I don't know.
Bill, I think you raise a really essential idea, which is this ties into the January 6th discussion of a moment ago, which is that one of the pieces of data that's come out of an analysis of January 6th, Robert Pape at the University of Chicago looked, he said, well, what is it that ties these people together, these insurrectionists? It tends to be that they come from counties that are overwhelmingly white that have had a measurable uptick in diversity. Theda Skocpol, who has thought more about the sort of origins of the very far right now than almost anybody else, particularly the Tea Party, will tell you that, you know, government dysfunction, that sort of that the expression that the government is the problem, or ultimately, when you dig far enough, you get to this core root, this reality that the white majority is, in every conceivable political way, rebelling against the reality of a more diverse country. And that is the enduring fact. And we're seeing it sort of come out in all of these permutations, violent and political and elsewhere.
So Evan, you know, here's the thing. We're talking about these counties that were overwhelmingly white, that experienced a significant uptick in diversity. Do you know the fundamental county we're talking about is Queens? It is not a coincidence that the most xenophobic political figure in modern American life is a product of the most statistically the most diverse county in the United States. And I know this growing up in Queens. Trump is a generation older than me. His version of Queens was the second whitest borough of New York City. My version of Queens was the most diverse county in the United States. That was why in 2016, no one spoke that language as fluently as Trump did, because it was the language of the Archie Bunker era resentments of white working class and elite residents of Queens. He'd heard that language his whole life. It's important to also keep in mind that when we look at the history of populism in the United States, particularly right-wing populism, they have always had a certain ratio of completely batshit crazy.
Is that a technical term?
That's an academic. That is a technical term. Political scientists use that term. That obscures an actual valid critique somewhere. Like, when you sift through enough, you find like, oh, wait, this actual thing was true. And they found this thing that was true, and then they ran off in the most nutty, like, completely insane direction possible. But they actually did have a sense that something was taking advantage of them in a way that they couldn't really articulate.
One of the unusual aspects of our democracy is its kind of uniquely counter-majoritarianism sort of nature. And the founders were really afraid of factions and democratic majorities, and they built in all these kind of protections. The Electoral College, the Supreme Court, the Senate. What were they so afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really important to recognize is how truly innovative what they were setting up was. I mean, what they were trying to do with the House of Representatives was have a system of true representation. It was completely destroyed by the compromise over slavery and the 3/5 clause. But the idea of representation by numerical representation, that element of democracy, which was an artifact of the emerging science of demography, that you could actually reliably count people and then have people be represented in the proportion to how many people there are. That's actually like a hugely big idea. But then they really freaked out about doing that. And so they're like, okay, well, we'll do the Senate and that will be basically ruled by property. But they were rejecting literally ruling by, they were literally going to do the Senate by wealth, by the wealth of the state. You'd have proportionate representation by wealth. So all of these aristocratic measures that were put in the U.S. Constitution and were then copied by, I mean, it's the most influential written constitution in the world. They were copied by other constitutions. All the other countries in the world that adopted those things in their written constitution in imitation of ours amended them out of their constitutions. We are the only nation in the world that doesn't elect our own president by numbers. But our amendment provision was also a compromise with the slave states, with the Deep South slave states. And so the reason we can't amend the Constitution really is because of slavery. And the things that would really repair, we need to abolish the Electoral College, we need to get rid of unequal suffrage in Senate, and we need to have term, like, you can't do those things unless you can amend the Constitution, which we can't do.
I would often talk with my students about the New York City subway. All of the cities that adopted, you know, metros or rail subways after New York City benefited from seeing what didn't work in New York City. Same thing with LaGuardia Airport, which was one of the earlier airports. We've made some progress with LaGuardia. But if you were 2 or 3 years ago going to LaGuardia, going, like, look how early we built an airport. And so the same thing, you know, applies to our Constitution in some ways.
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. His books include The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. Jill Lepore is the author of These Truths and many other books. And Evan Osnos's Wildland came out in 2021. They spoke with editor Michael Luo at the New Yorker Festival in October. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell.
This week's episode was produced with assistance from Catherine Sterling, Amanda Miller, Nico Brown, Michael Etherington, and others from the New Yorker Festival.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.